Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the deadlocked talks over debt reduction between the White House and the President, where it appears that John Boehner, feeling the heat from his Tea Party caucus, is backing out of a deal he made to raise taxes, while it appears Obama has adopted the language of the Republicans in tying the economy to the debt. Richard Parker, an economist at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, joins us. Then we will go to Juba, the capital of South Sudan, a brand new country as of Saturday, and talk with Susan Purdon, who is the country director for South Sudan for the International Rescue Committee. She will fill us in on the festivities and assess the grave challenges ahead for this new country born out of years of civil war with the North. Then finally, we'll talk about the congressional race in the 36th District, nearby in the South Bay, Marina, Mar Vista, and Venice area, where a Tea Party Republican is running against Janice Hahn for the seat that Jane Harman vacated. Former two-term mayor of Manhattan Beach, Mitch Ward, joins us ahead of Tuesday's vote to get an update on a tight race in a predominantly Democratic district where the wealthy Tea Party candidate is pulling out all the stops, hoping for an upset that could resonate across the nation. I'm joined by Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts, was the co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myths of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Delighted to be with you, Ian, and in light of the story that's going to follow mine, I should mention that I was born and raised in Hermosa Beach, Jane Harman's old district. So,
well, it's a pretty bizarre turn of events that the seat's even threatened.
Shocking, absolutely shocking to me. So I'm not terrified yet, but I'm
no. Well, I think the purpose of my doing the interview is hopefully to stimulate people to get out to vote, you know, because
If I weren't re-registered in Cambridge, where my vote is less useful, I'd re-register instantly in Hermosa again. So,
well, let's talk about. And I also wanted to talk to you about, since you've just come back from Athens, Greece, where you've been working with Prime Minister Papandreou of Greece on the onerous debt packages that the Eurozone has imposed on Greece, so that it doesn't default. But let's talk about the big story here, and that is these negotiations between the White House and John Boehner. And it appears that over the 4th of July weekend, a deal was made where Boehner said that they would, the tax cuts on the wealthy, would the Republicans would allow them to expire. And apparently also President Obama put Medicare cuts on the table as well. And now it appears that Boehner has backed out of that deal, and the White House wants a big deal. The Republicans want a little deal. Is that what you understand?
Well, it's the outlines of what I understand. I guess there are several comments because several things are moving here simultaneously. The fact that these deficits have not closed is a function of the failure of the U.S. economy to recover from the collapse of the Great Recession of 2008-2009, and that, I should note, is the same thing that's driving the predicament in Greece. In other words, both the United States and Europe are not recovering quickly from the financial market meltdown created by Wall Street's flimflammery over the past two decades. And in each, it's producing a crisis that has become a fiscal crisis for the state as a consequence of financial market failure. In the United States, it is the perception that the Obama stimulus that he used on top of the TARP spending by President Bush have not been sufficiently efficient to generate jobs at a cost equal to what's being spent on the stimulus. I disagree with that, but we can talk about that. Similarly, the question of Greece is one of what is it worth to Europe to save Greece if it's a question only of Greece or it's a question of Europe's future as well. And that debate is the one that is the version of this taxes versus revenue versus expenditure cuts going on in the U.S.
But surely, Richard Parker, the fundamental difference here is that Greece has a real crisis, where the United States has a phony crisis, in the sense that Republicans are using extortion and the fear of shutting down the good credit and faith of the United States in order to get what they want in these negotiations. They are using leverage that is frankly insane.
I think that's right, although let me just say about the Greeks, I think that theirs is now a phony crisis in the following sense. They have done everything imaginable to solve their problem within the confines of the Greek economy itself. And if the Greek economy were not part of the Eurozone, in fact, what they have done today would get them well on the way to recovery. Because they're tied to the Eurozone, nothing that they do alone can solve their problem. And so, in a sense, they're being held hostage by the politics of Northern Europe and the reluctance of conservatives in Northern Europe to come to the aid of a fellow European country. And in that sense, I think there is a parallel. I think that, I'd argue for that. Now, to come back to the United States, I mean, I think that the problem here is a problem that we sometimes forget is not a new problem. That is that the ability to gridlock between the parties is actually quite old. If you think back to the 1950s, when it was on issues of national security and McCarthyism, the parties were quite capable of gridlocking around a whole number of issues. Similarly, in the 1950s and 1960s, until the election of 1964, when in the wake of Kennedy's death, a vast majority of Democrats from outside the South were swept into office, there was gridlock for all intents and purposes on civil rights. Then in the 1980s, you had gridlock around budgetary issues that led to the kind of proposals that would later be characterized as lockbox proposals, the Graham I'm blanking on the name of the bill, but the idea was that there would be that when Congress failed to agree on necessary cuts in the budget, that an automatic cut machine would take over and administer the cuts. Essentially, the Congress walking away from its constitutional responsibilities alongside the White House. And then in the 1990s, of course, you had the Republicans under Newt Gingrich willing to shut the government down not once but twice. Now, you know, I don't think that they're actually willing on the Boehner side, which is I don't want to describe as the moderate wing of the party, but the less ultra-conservative wing of the party, that they really want to shut down the government or even dare shut down the government. I think that they're terrified of what their ultra-white right wing is pressing them to do. But I think that we're going to have to play showdown and chicken all over again this summer around debt limit extension to sort this out again. Now, did I oppose President Obama getting into these negotiations and accepting the frame of the negotiations as they were established by the Republicans? Yeah, I think that was a bad political tactic, but it's also characteristic of what Obama seems to like to do, which is to move to the center and then open negotiations from there, no matter where his opposite number stands. And, you know, I don't know who taught him negotiation at Harvard Law School, but that's not what my colleagues teach at the Kennedy School about how to do negotiations. That said, if Boehner is backing out of this big deal, and in fact you get so much ruckus raised about doing an even smaller deal by the right, and I'm not sure that that won't happen, Obama may come out of this better than we thought, and that may be ultimately what Obama's counting on, which is that the insane wing of the institutionalized wing or institutionalizable wing of the Republican Party is going to box Boehner in so badly that Obama will ultimately emerge from this not having had to give up much of anything, but with the Republicans looking disorganized and penurious and only for the rich once again. But we have yet to see whether that gets played out that way.
Well, the fact of the matter is that it appears that Obama has adopted the language of the Republicans in tying the economy to the debt, and that Boehner's fallback position is the one that Vice President Biden offered. So they've already given away the store. Apparently they're negotiating a bigger deal to give away more of the store in terms of Medicaid, but that was tied to tax cuts for the wealthy or letting them expire. Now, there's bad blood between Cantor and Boehner. I think Cantor is quite happy to see Boehner twist in the wind here. But I still get back to Richard Parker to this puzzlement over why accept this insane leverage in the first place. If somebody is pours gasoline over themselves and threatening to light a match, you get the fire hose. You don't then say, oh, wait a minute, let me pour gasoline over myself, and then we can negotiate.
I like the metaphor here. Well, again, I mean, you know, we've seen this about Obama, and people on the left and liberal side of the spectrum have been complaining about this since the very first negotiations, such as they were, about the Obama package, the Obama stimulus package in the spring of 2009. If you'll recall, you know, Charlie Grassley and others said, well, we're not going to support a stimulus package this big unless there are big tax breaks put into this, tax cuts put into this as part of the package. Obama then immediately rolled over and said, okay, made something like 40% of the package tax cuts rather than stimulus spending. And, of course, not one of the Republicans, including Grassley, voted for it.
And so we know that the stimulus has run out.
They're going to do this. Right, exactly.
And that's the reason why the economy stalled, and that's the reason why unemployment jumped to 9.2%, and the Labor Department's report showing virtually no job growth has made everybody incredibly depressed, but it shouldn't be a surprise. This is the nature of it. Now, do you believe, Richard, what Chuck Schumer said the other day, that it looks like the Republicans are sabotaging the recovery for political gain?
I think that they're willing to sabotage the recovery. I don't think you can speak of them as unitary, the Republicans. I think that they're divided, but I think that the net effect is that they're willing to do so because they want to tell a story about this as an ongoing failure to recover because of quote-unquote democratic methods being used to solve the problem. They view this as an Antietam or a Gettysburg kind of struggle, that they're going to have to win on this. This is for them part of the civil war that they've conducted now around these budgetary issues for the last 30 years. As I noted earlier, I mean, they've been in the past around national security issues or around race issues, but now they're around budgetary issues. And, you know, they have done for their core clientele, that the top 10% or the top 1% of Americans, they have done extremely well for that clientele over the last 30 years. I don't need to rehash for you the numbers about income and wealth distribution. And so why should they back down now? I mean, ultimately, you know, the idea that the economy's recovery is wrecked in terms of employment gains is not of enormous concern as long as corporate profits are healthy. And we've had now 2 years since the bottom of the recovery in which corporate profits have been not just healthy, but spectacular, in fact, record spectacular, and we've seen no significant rundown in terms of unemployment. So I'm not sure that when we talk about wrecking the economy, we're talking about the same thing, because I don't think we should all be thinking that we're all concerned about the same economy. The economy has many different faces, and for the investing classes and the working classes, they happen to be two different economies.
Yeah, but you just got through Richard Parker saying that, in effect, Obama asked for too little when he was riding in on all of that support that he had back in when he first came into office. The first thing that they tried to do was to stimulate the economy. He accepted tax cuts instead of real spending, and lots of economists, including Paul Krugman and others, argued the stimulus wasn't enough and it was going to peter out, and they've been absolutely right. It's petered out at this crucial moment, just as we're beginning the campaigns, it seems. So again, the Republicans have a very effective narrative, even though it's a bogus one. The deficit hoax, if you will, has become the narrative instead of the revenue crisis. And I don't understand why it is that we can't the president can't make these points that really it's all about jobs. If you got people back to work, the deficit would go away. It would be a non-issue. Why have they accepted their rhetoric and boxed themselves into this phony narrative?
You know, again, I mean, I'm an economist. I'm not a political analyst as such who stays still closely in touch with all that goes on inside the Beltway. But what I know about the Beltway are several things. First of all, there is an upper middle class professional community there directly tied to politics as an industry. It is not affected by the larger the economic cycles outside of the Beltway. In fact, the Washington housing market has continued to rise for the last 5 years, where every place else housing has collapsed. It's a reflection of the prosperity that goes with a kind of permanent government-business relationship. And in that permanent government-business relationship, the professionals working this year on the government side anticipate that at some point in the future, they're going to work on the business side. And it's the business side, law and corporations, that offer the most lucrative remuneration. And I don't think that in this period that people think that they want to soil the possible nest in which they would land once their government careers are over. So I think that's issue number one, is just the structure of the way the class operates inside of Washington. And it's not even a partisan issue. It's a fully bipartisan issue. The second is that we're now moving into the fundraising drive, the first big fundraising push of the presidential campaign. And we know that Wall Street has frightened Democratic fundraisers, including Schumer, with this bogus narrative that Obama has not done enough for Wall Street. You and I would disagree with that vividly, but to the degree that it locks up checkbooks on Wall Street, the Democrats in the White House are very worried about how to unlock those checkbooks, because their position is they need money first of all. They've got plenty of time to deliver the votes, and most of the left and liberal wing of the Democratic Party is not going to go anyplace. They'll, you know, complain, they'll howl, they'll whimper, they'll cry, but they're not going to abandon the Democratic Party in favor of the Republican Party when push comes to shove. So that leads us to number three, which is, how do you position yourself to make clear to donors and to the media that reflect the interests of donors what it is that you will stand for? And if, in fact, you're willing to signal your flexibility on issues of taxation of the well-to-do and an eagerness to cut the cost of government when it involves expenditures on the middle, working, and poor, middle class, working class, and poor, then you're setting yourself up for a rich haul over the next 12 months during this first electoral cycle, which is basically the fundraising electoral cycle. And given that Obama feels that he's likely to face, you know, well-financed Republican opposition, having your money in place in this off year in anticipation of going into 12 is more important than courting voters, all things else being equal. So, you know, I think those are all factors, and I think that we can't walk away from them. We may not like them, but they do seem to me to be the factors that are most relevant here as you watch Obama behave the way he does.
Well, I suppose in a way, Richard Parker, what you're saying is that we're in an era where money is more important than votes, and that the power of money is greater than the power of votes. And the reason that the president isn't pointing out at this very moment, Wall Street is enjoying record profits and record bonuses, and we just learned the pay of the corporate CEOs has gone up astronomically, with I think the head of Viacom getting some huge package of $80-90 million plus. And I think all the polls indicate that the average American does actually think is concerned about the disparity in wealth in this country.
Absolutely. And it's bipartisan concern. I mean, you look at the number of Americans, and it's up on the level of 70-80% of Americans are upset about this. And that's not all Democrats. I mean, that includes a large number of independents and of Republicans. And yet the lesson for politicians coming out of the 2010 election was, Obama's got no coattails, and the Democratic narrative isn't strong enough to keep Democrats in office. And in fact, an aggressive Republican counterattack led to essentially, you know, something that looked like the Somme, or, you know, a World War One battlefield circa 1917. I mean, there was a slaughter of the Democratic Party in the congressional elections of 2010, and that memory is far more vivid for elected officials than polls. Polls can move, polls can be made to move, but when you watch 65 of your colleagues vaporize in an election that was unprecedented, basically, in terms of the size of the losses, you know, you take a lesson out of that about, well, maybe they aren't as strong as they say they are in the polls about caring about this issue. So,
well, that's one way to look at it. Richard Parker, again, Richard Parker teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He's just returned from Athens, Greece, where he's been consulting with Prime Minister Papandreou of Greece on their debt packages imposed by the European Union. But if you look at the simple statistics of in 2008, 140 million Americans voted. In 2010, only 75 million Americans voted. To my mind, the lesson is that the people who voted for Obama in 2008, half of them didn't show up because they weren't inspired, whereas they were before. And I think you have to give George W. Bush credit for inspiring people to vote for Obama. What happened to that energy? And have they lost it? Is there any way to recapture it? Is it because people feel disappointed? They had unrealistic expectations. Whatever the answers are, the reality is, and unless those 140 million come back in 2012, the Republicans are going to win.
Right. Now, just a couple things. One, the rule of thumb is that in off-year elections, meaning non-presidential mm-hmm. elections, you're going to vaporize 30 to 40% of presidential year voters. So just if the cycle had followed normal course, you would have chopped that 140 down to about 90 or something like that. So it isn't the absolute fall from the 2008 to the 2010 number that is so dismaying. It is that the 2010 number was so remarkably strong in terms of absolute number of voters, and then in terms of the composition of voters, the number of voters who are not historically believers in the electoral system. And I think you're absolutely on point about your core idea that, you know, Obama's voters, the voters that were most inspired by Obama, seem to have been the ones on the liberal side to have stayed home. And that, on the other hand, we should mention that in the interim, there was a part of the right that was inspired by the emergence of the Tea Party in a way that probably pushed their numbers up significantly, even as liberal numbers were falling. So there were two processes at work, both connected with the behavior of the Obama administration, to be sure.
Well, what's your prediction then in closing, Richard Parker, about how these negotiations will take place, will pan out, given the apparent peculiar negotiating strategy of the White House, where they come in with too little and end up accepting too little?
My prediction is that the two sides will find their way to a package smaller than the Biden package, which they had previously negotiated. And secondly, that we're going to dance up to the edge of debt default at least once, if not twice, before they get to that reduced package. And that in the aftermath, you're then going to have a media duel about who won and who lost over that. And that that will be overwhelmed by new rolling news about the U.S. economy not recovering, more trouble in Europe. Just anticipate in the next week that the Europeans are going to announce the results of new stress tests on the European banking system, and I promise you that the news is not going to be good, and it's going to frighten markets again, and we're going to start back on another one of these chicken little sky is falling kinds of narratives that are going to dominate the press. So that I think that what we're going to get is less than either side originally anticipated. We're going to do it in a climate of more hysteria, and that whatever the result is, it's going to be overwhelmed by yet more bad news to come, both from outside the U.S. and inside the U.S. as these economies of the West fail to recover because of these mad austerity programs that the right is imposing on both sides of the Atlantic.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Parker.
Ian, good to talk with you as always, and good luck in Manhattan Beach.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He just returned from Greece, where he's been consulting with Prime Minister Papandreou over their problems with their mounting debt. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and go to Juba, the capital of the new country of South Sudan.
Can't get health if you don't have wealth. Can't fix schools if we don't have tools. Can't afford the gas to fill up the tank. Big boys are taking us to the bank. The corporations hate it like a lover scorn. They want freedom to buy politicians. Of course they would rather keep with tradition.
Yeah.